Riviera said.
Maybe 3 Jane won't go for that, Peter,
Case said, uncertain of the impulse. The derms still raged in his system, the old fever starting to grip him, Night City craziness. He remembered moments of grace, dealing out on the edge of things, where he'd found that he could sometimes talk faster than he could think. The gray eyes narrowed.
Why, Case? Why do you think that?
Case smiled. Riviera didn't know about the Simstim rig. He'd missed it in his flurry to find the drugs she carried for him. But how could Hideo have missed it? And Case was certain the ninja would never have let 3 Jane treat Molly without first checking her for kinks and concealed weapons. No, he decided. The ninja knew, so 3 Jane would know as well.
Tell me, Case,
Riviera said, raising the pepperbox muzzle of the Fletcher. Something creaked behind him. Creaked again. 3 Jane pushed Molly out of the shadows in an ornate Victorian bath chair, its tall, spidery wheels squeaking as they turned. Molly was bundled deep in a red and black striped blanket, the narrow, caned back of the antique chair towering above her. She looked very small, broken. A patch of brilliantly white micropore covered her damaged lens. The other flashed emptily as her head bobbed with the motion of the chair.
A familiar face, 3 Jane said. I saw you the night of Peter's show. And who is this?
Malcolm, Case said.
Hideo, remove the arrow and bandage Mr. Malcolm's wound.
Case was staring at Molly, at the wan face. The ninja walked to where Malcolm sat, pausing to lay his bow and the shotgun well out of reach, and took something from his pocket, a pair of bolt cutters.
I must cut the shaft, he said. It is too near the artery.
Malcolm nodded. His face was grayish and sheened with sweat. Case looked at 3 Jane.
There isn't much time, he said.
For whom, exactly?
For any of us.
There was a snap as Hideo cut through the metal shaft of the arrow. Malcolm groaned.
Really,
Riviera said, it won't amuse you to hear this failed con artist make a last desperate pitch. Most distasteful, I can assure you. He'll wind up on his knees, offer to sell you his mother, perform the most boring sexual favors.
3 Jane threw back her head and laughed. Wouldn't I, Peter?
The ghosts are going to mix it tonight, lady, Case said. Wintermute's going up against the other one, Neuromancer, for keeps. You know that?
3 Jane raised her eyebrows.
Peter suggested something like that, but tell me more.
I met Neuromancer. He talked about your mother. I think he's something like a giant ROM construct for recording personality, only it's full RAM. The constructs think they're there, like it's real, but it just goes on forever.
3 Jane stepped from behind the bath chair.
Where? Describe the place, this construct.
A beach, gray sand, like silver, that needs polishing. And a concrete thing, kind of bunker.
He hesitated.
It's nothing fancy, just old, falling apart. If you walk far enough, you come back to where you started.
Yes, she said. Morocco. When Marie France was a girl, years before she married Ashpool, she spent a summer alone on that beach, camping in an abandoned blockhouse. She formulated the basis of her philosophy there.
Hideo straightened, slipping the cutters into his work pants. He held a section of the arrow in either hand. Malcolm had his eyes closed, his hand clapped tight around his bicep.
I will bandage it, Hideo said.
Case managed to fall before Riviera could level the Fletcher for a clear shot. The darts whined past his neck like supersonic gnats. He rolled, seeing Hideo pivot through yet another step of his dance, the razored point of the arrow reversed in his hand, shaft flat along palm and rigid fingers. He flicked it underhand, wrist blurring, into the back of Riviera's hand. The Fletcher struck the tiles a meter away. Riviera screamed, but not in pain. It was a shriek of rage, so pure, so refined, that it lacked all humanity. Twin tight beams of light, ruby-red needles, stabbed from the region of Riviera's sternum. The ninja grunted, reeled back, hands to his eyes, then found his balance.
"Peter," 3Jane said. "Peter, what have you done?"
"He's blinded your clone boy," Molly said flatly.
Hideo lowered his cupped hands. Frozen on the white tile, Case saw wisps of steam drift from the ruined eyes. Riviera smiled. Hideo swung into his dance, retracing his steps. When he stood above the bow, the arrow, and the Remington, Riviera's smile had faded. He bent, bowing, it seemed to Case, and found the bow and arrow.
"You're blind,"
Riviera said, taking a step backward.
"Peter,"
3Jane said,
"don't you know he does it in the dark? Zen. It's the way he practices."
The ninja notched his arrow. "Will you distract me with your holograms now?" Riviera was backing away, into the dark beyond the pool. He brushed against a white chair. Its feet rattled on the tile. Hideo's arrow twitched. Riviera broke and ran, throwing himself over a low, jagged length of wall. The ninja's face was rapt, suffused with a quiet ecstasy. Smiling, he padded off into the shadows beyond the wall, his weapon held ready.
"Jane, lady,"
Malcolm whispered, and Case turned to see him scoop the shotgun from the tiles, blood spattering the white ceramic. He shook his locks and lay the fat barrel in the crook of his wounded arm.
"This take your head off. No Babylon doctor fix it."
3Jane stared at the Remington. Molly freed her arms from the folds of the striped blanket, raising the black sphere that encased her hands.
"Off,"
she said.
"Get it off."
Case rose from the tiles, shook himself.
"Hideo will get him, even blind?"
he asked 3Jane.
"When I was a child," she said, "we loved to blindfold him. He put arrows through the pips and playing cards at 10 meters.
"Peter's good as dead anyway,"
Molly said.
"In another 12 hours, he'll start to freeze up. Won't be able to move. His eyes is all."
"Why?"
Case turned to her.
"I poisoned his shit for him,"
she said.
"Conditions like Parkinson's disease, sort of."
3Jane nodded.
"Yes. We ran the usual medical scan before he was admitted."
She touched the ball in a certain way, and it sprang away from Molly's hands.
"Selective destruction of the cells of the substantia nigra, signs of the formation of a Lewy body. He sweats a great deal in his sleep."
"Ollie,"
Molly said, 10 blades glittering, exposed for an instant. She tugged the blanket away from her legs, revealing the inflated cast.
"It's the meperidine. I had Ali make me up a custom batch, speeded up the reaction times with higher temperatures. N-methyl-4-phenyl-1-2-3-6,
she sang, like a child reciting the steps of a sidewalk game.
Tetrahydropyridine.
"A hot shot,"
Case said.
"Yeah,"
Molly said.
"A real slow hot shot."
"That's appalling,"
3Jane said, and giggled. It was crowded in the elevator. Case was jammed pelvis to pelvis with 3Jane, the muzzle of the Remington under her chin. She grinned and ground against him.
"You stop,"
he said, feeling helpless. He had the gun safety on, but he was terrified of injuring her, and she knew it. The elevator was a steel cylinder, under a meter in diameter, intended for a single passenger. Malcolm had Molly in his arms. She'd bandaged his wound, but it obviously hurt him to carry her. Her hip was pressing the deck and construct into Case's kidneys. They rose out of gravity, toward the axis, the cores. The entrance to the elevator had been concealed beside the stairs to the corridor, another touch in 3Jane's private cave decor.
"I don't suppose I should tell you this,"
3Jane said, craning her head to allow her chin to clear the muzzle of the gun.
"But I don't have a key to the room you want. I never have had one. One of my father's Victorian awkwardnesses. The lock is mechanical and extremely complex."
"Chubb lock,"
Molly said, her voice muffled by Malcolm's shoulder.
"And we got the fucking key. No fear."
"That chibier's still working?" Case asked her.
"It's 8:25 p.m. Greenwich fucking mean,"
she said. "We got 5 minutes," Case said, as the door snapped open behind 3Jane. She flipped backward in a slow somersault, the pale folds of her jalaba billowing around her thighs. They were at the axis, the core of Billa Straylight. Chapter 23. Molly fished the key out on its loop of nylon.
"You know,"
3Jane said, craning forward with interest,
"I was under the impression that no duplicate existed. I sent Hideo to search my father's things after you killed him. He couldn't find the original."
"Wintermute managed to get it stuck in the back of a drawer,"
Molly said, carefully inserting the Chubb key's cylindrical shaft into the notched opening in the face of the blank, rectangular door.
"He killed the little kid who put it there."
The key rotated smoothly when she tried it.
"The head," Case said. "There's a panel in the back of the head. Zircon's on it. Get it off. That's where I'm jacking in."
And then they were inside.
"Christ on a crutch," the flatline drawled. "You do believe in taking your own good time, don't you, boy?"
"Quang's ready?"
"Hot to trot."
"Okay."
He flipped, and found himself staring down, through Molly's one good eye, at a white-faced, wasted figure, afloat in a loose fetal crouch, a cyberspace deck between its thighs, a band of silver trodes above closed, shadowed eyes. The man's cheeks were hollowed with a day's growth of dark beard, his face slick with sweat. He was looking at himself. Molly had her Fletcher in her hand. Her leg throbbed with each beat of her pulse, but she could still maneuver in zero-G. Malcolm drifted nearby, 3Jane's thin arm gripped in a large brown hand. A ribbon of fiber optics looped gracefully from the Onosendai to a square opening in the back of the pearl-crusted terminal. He tapped the switch again.
"Quang grade Mark 11 is hauling ass in 9 seconds, counting. 7, 6, 5.
The flatline punched them up. Smooth ascent. The ventral surface of the black chrome shark, a microsecond flick of darkness.
4, 3.
Case had the strange impression of being in the pilot seat in a small plane. A flat, dark surface in front of him suddenly glowed with a perfect reproduction of the keyboard of his deck.
2, and kick ass!
Headlong motion through the walls of emerald green, milky jade, the sensation of speed beyond anything he'd known before in cyberspace. The Tessier-Ashpool ice shattered, peeling away from the Chinese program's thrust. A worrying impression of solid fluidity, as though the shards of a broken mirror bent and elongated as they fell.
"Christ,"
Case said, awestruck, as Quang twisted and banked above the horizonless fields of the Tessier-Ashpool cores, an endless neon cityscape, complexity that cut the eye, jewel bright, sharp as razors.
"Hey, shit,"
the construct said.
"Those things are the RCA building. You know the old RCA building?"
The Quang program dived past the gleaming spires of a dozen identical towers of data, each one a blue neon replica of the Manhattan skyscraper.
"You ever see resolution this high?"
Case asked.
No, but I never cracked an AI either. This thing know where it's going? It better.
They were dropping, losing altitude in a canyon of rainbow neon.
Diggs.
An arm of shadow was uncoiling from the flickering floor below. A seething mass of darkness, unformed, shapeless.
Company,
the flatline said, as Case hit the representation of his deck, fingers flying automatically across the board. The Quang swerved sickeningly, then reversed, whipping itself backward, shattering the illusion of a physical vehicle. The shadow thing was growing, spreading, blotting out the city of data. Case took them straight up, above them the distanceless bowl of jade-green ice. The city of the cores was gone now, obscured entirely by the dark beneath them.
What is it?
An AI's defense system,
the construct said.
Or part of it. If it's your pal Wintermute, he's not looking real friendly.
Take it, Case said. You're faster.
Now, your best defense, boy, is a good offense.
And the flatline aligned the nose of Quang's sting with the center of the dark below, and dove. Case's sensory input warped with their velocity. His mouth filled with an aching taste of blue. His eyes were eggs of unstable crystal, vibrating with a frequency whose name was rain and the sound of trains, suddenly sprouting a humming forest of hair-fine glass spines. The spines split, bisected, split again, exponential growth under the dome of the Tessier Ashpool ice. The roof of his mouth cleaved painlessly, admitting rootlets that whipped around his tongue, hungry for the taste of blue, to feed the crystal forests of his eyes, forests that pressed against the green dome, pressed and were hindered and spread, growing down, filling the universe of TA, down into the waiting, hapless suburbs of the city that was the mind of Tessier Ashpool, S.A. And he was remembering an ancient story, a king placing coins on a chessboard, doubling the amount at each square. Exponential. Darkness fell in from every side, a sphere of singing black, pressure on the extended crystal nerves of the universe of data he had nearly become. And when he was nothing, compressed at the heart of all that dark, there came a point where the dark could be no more, and something tore. The Quang program spurted from tarnished cloud. Case's consciousness divided, like beads of mercury, arcing above an endless beach, the color of the dark silver clouds. His vision was spherical, as though a single retina lined the inner surface of a globe that contained all things, if all things could be counted. And here, things could be counted. Each one. He knew the number of grains of sand in the construct of the beach. A number coded in a mathematical system that existed nowhere outside the mind that was Neuromancer. He knew the number of yellow food packets in the canisters in the bunker, 407. He knew the number of brass teeth in the left half of the open zipper of the salt-crusted leather jacket that Linda Lee wore as she trudged along the sunset beach, swinging a stick of driftwood in her hand, 202. He banked Quang above the beach and swung the program in a wide circle, seeing the black shark thing through her eyes, a silent ghost hungry against the banks of lowering cloud. She cringed, dropping her stick, and ran. He knew the rate of her pulse, the length of her stride in measurements that would have satisfied the most exacting standards of geophysics.
"But you do not know her thoughts,"
the boy said. Beside him now, in the shark thing's heart.
I do not know her thoughts. You were wrong, Case. To live here is to live. There is no difference.
Linda, in her panic, plunging blind through the surf.
Stop her, he said. She'll hurt herself.
I can't stop her,
the boy said, his gray eyes mild and beautiful.
You've got Riviera's eyes,
Case said. There was a flash of white teeth, long pink gums.
But not his craziness, because they are beautiful to me.
He shrugged.
I need no mask to speak with you, unlike my brother, I create my own personality. Personality is my medium.
Case took them up a steep climb, away from the beach and the frightened girl.
Why'd you throw her up to me, you little prick? Over and fucking over, and turning me around. You killed her, huh? In Chiba?
No,
the boy said.
Wintermute?
No. I saw her death coming, in the patterns you sometimes imagined you could detect in the dance of the street. Those patterns are real. I am complex enough, in my narrow ways, to read those dances. Far better than Wintermute can. I saw her death in her need for you, in the magnetic code of the lock on the door of your coffin in Cheap Hotel, in Julie Dean's account with a Hong Kong shirtmaker. As clear to me as the shadow of a tumor to a surgeon studying a patient's scan. When she took your Hitachi to her boy to try to access it, she had no idea what it carried, still less how she might sell it, and her deepest wish was that you would pursue and punish her. I intervened. My methods are far more subtle than Wintermute's. I brought her here, into myself.
Why?
Hoping I could bring you here as well, keep you here. But I failed.
So what now?
He swung them back into the bank of cloud.
Where do we go from here?
I don't know, Case. Tonight the very Matrix asks itself that question, because you have won. You have already won, don't you see? You won when you walked away from her on the beach. She was my last line of defense. I die soon, in one sense, as does Wintermute, as surely as Riviera does, now, as he lies paralyzed beside the stump of a wall in the apartments of my Lady 3 Jane Marie France, his Nigra striatal system unable to produce the dopamine receptors that could save him from Hideo's arrow. But Riviera will survive only as these eyes, if I am allowed to keep them.
There's the word, right? The code. So how have I won? I've won jack shit.
Flip now.
Where's Dixie? What have you done with the flatline?
McCoy Pauly has his wish,
the boy said, and smiled.
His wish and more. He punched you here against my wish, drove himself through defenses equal to anything in the Matrix. Now flip.
And Case was alone in Kwong's black sting, lost in cloud. He flipped. Into Molly's tension, her back like rock, her hands around 3 Jane's throat.
Funny, she said. I know exactly what you'd look like. I saw it after Ashpool did the same thing to your clone sister.
Her hands were gentle, almost a caress. 3 Jane's eyes were wide with terror and lust. She was shivering with fear and longing. Beyond the free-fall tangle of 3 Jane's hair, Case saw his own strained white face, Malcolm behind him, brown hands on the leather-jacketed shoulders, steadying him above the carpet's pattern of woven circuitry.
Would you?
3 Jane asked, her voice a child's.
I think you would. The code,
Molly said.
Tell the head the code.
Jacking out.
She wants it, he screamed. The bitch wants it.
He opened his eyes to the cool ruby stare of the terminal, its platinum face crusted with pearl and lapis. Beyond it, Molly and 3 Jane twisted in a slow-motion embrace.
Give us the fucking code, he said. If you don't, what'll change? What'll ever fucking change for you? You'll wind up like the old man. You'll tear it all down and start building again. You'll build the walls back, tighter and tighter. I got no idea at all what'll happen if Wintermute wins, but it'll change something.
He was shaking, his teeth chattering. 3 Jane went limp, Molly's hands still around her slender throat, her dark hair drifting, tangled, a soft brown caul.
The Ducal Palace at Mantua,
she said,
contains a series of increasingly smaller rooms. They twine around the grand apartments, beyond beautifully carved door frames, one stoops to enter. They housed the court dwarfs.
She smiled wanly.
I might aspire to that, I suppose, but in a sense my family has already accomplished a grander version of the same scheme.
Her eyes were calm now, distant. Then she gazed down at Case.
Take your word, thief.
He jacked. Quang slid out of the clouds. Below him, the neon city. Behind him, a sphere of darkness dwindled.
Dixie, you hear, man? You hear me, Dixie?
He was alone.
Fucker got you, he said.
Blind momentum as he hurtled across the infinite datascape.
You gotta hate somebody before this is over, said the Finn's voice. Them, me, it doesn't matter.
Where's Dixie?
That's kinda hard to explain, Case.
A sense of the Finn's presence surrounded him, smell of Cuban cigarettes, smoke locked in musty tweed, old machines given up to the mineral rituals of rust.
Hate'll get you through, the voice said. So many little triggers in the brain, and you just go yanking them all. Now you gotta hate. The lock that screens the hardwiring. It's down under those towers the flatline showed you when you came in. He won't try to stop you.
Neuromancer, Case said.
His name's not something I can know, but he's given up now. It's the TA ice you gotta worry about. Not the wall, but internal virus systems. Quang's wide open to some of the stuff they got running loose in here.
Hate, Case said. Who do I hate? You tell me.
Who do you love?
The Finn's voice asked. He whipped the program through a turn and dived for the blue towers. Things were launching themselves from the ornate sunburst spires, glittering leech shapes made of shifting planes of light. There were hundreds of them, rising in a whirl, their movements random as windblown paper down dawn streets.
Glitch systems, the voice said.
He came in steep, fueled by self-loathing. When the Quang program met the first of the defenders, scattering the leaves of light, he felt the shark thing lose a degree of substantiality, the fabric of information loosening. And then, old alchemy of the brain and its vast pharmacy, his hate flowed into his hands. In the instant before he drove Quang's sting through the base of the first tower, he attained a level of proficiency exceeding anything he'd known or imagined. Beyond ego, beyond personality, beyond awareness, he moved, Quang moving with him, evading his attackers with an ancient dance, Hideo's dance, grace of the mind-body interface granted him in that second by the clarity and singleness of his wish to die. And one step in that dance was the lightest touch on the switch, barely enough to flip.
Now.
And his voice the cry of a bird, unknown. Three Jane answering in song. Three notes, high and pure. A true name. Neon forest, rain sizzling across hot pavement, the smell of frying food, a girl's hands locked across the small of his back in the sweating darkness of a portside coffin. But all of this receding, as the cityscape recedes, city as Chiba, as the ranked data of Tessier Ashpool S.A., as the roads and crossroads scribed on the face of a microchip, the sweat-stained pattern on a folded, knotted scarf. Waking to a voice that was music, the platinum terminal piping melodically, endlessly, speaking of numbered Swiss accounts, of payment to be made to Zion via a Bahamian orbital bank, of passports and passages, and of deep and basic changes to be effected
in the memory of touring. Touring. He remembered stenciled flesh beneath a projected sky, spun beyond an iron railing. He remembered Desiderata Street. And the voice sang on, piping him back into the dark, but it was his own darkness, pulse and blood, the one where he'd always slept, behind his eyes, and no others. And he woke again, thinking he dreamed, to a wide white smile framed with gold incisors, Aerol strapping him into a G-web in Babylon Rocker. And then, the long pulse of Zion Dub. Coda. Departure and Arrival. Chapter 24. She was gone. He felt it when he opened the door of their suite at the Hyatt. Black futons, the pine floor polished to a dull gloss, the paper screens arranged with a care bred over centuries. She was gone. There was a note on the black lacquer bar cabinet beside the door, a single sheet of stationery folded once, weighted with the shuriken. He slid it from beneath the nine-pointed star and opened it. "Hey, it's okay, but it's taking the edge off my game. I paid the bill already. It's the way I'm wired, I guess. Watch your ass, okay? XXX. Molly." He crumpled the paper into a ball and dropped it beside the shuriken. He picked the star up and walked to the window, turning it in his hands. He'd found it in the pocket of his jacket, in Zion, when they were preparing to leave for the JAL station. He looked down at it. They'd passed the shop where she bought it for him, when they'd gone to Chiba together for the last of her operations. He'd gone to the Chatsubo that night, while she was in the clinic, and seen rats. Something had kept him away from the place on their five previous trips, but now he felt like going back. Rats had served him without the slightest glimmer of recognition. "Hey," he'd said, "it's me, Case." The old eyes regarding him out of their dark webs of wrinkled flesh.
"Ah,"
Rats had said, at last,
"the artiste."
The bartender shrugged.
"I came back."
The man shook his massive, stubbled head.
"Night City is not a place one returns to, artiste,"
he said, swabbing the bar in front of Case with a filthy cloth, the pink manipulator whining. And then he turned to serve another customer, and Case had finished his beer and left. Now he touched the points of the shuriken, one at a time, rotating it slowly in his fingers. Stars. Destiny. "I never even used the goddamn thing," he thought. "I never even found out what color her eyes were. She never showed me." Wintermute had won, had meshed somehow with Neuromancer and become something else, something that had spoken to them from the Platinum Head, explaining that it had altered the touring records, erasing all evidence of their crime. The passports Armitage had provided were valid, and they were both credited with large amounts in numbered Geneva accounts. Marcus Garvey would be returned eventually, and Malcolm and Aerol given money through the Bahamian bank that dealt with Zion Cluster. On the way back, in Babylon Rocker, Molly had explained what the voice had told her about the toxin sacks.
"Said it was taken care of, like it got so deep into your head it made your brain manufacture the enzyme. So they're loose now. The Zionites'll give you a blood change, complete flush out."
He stared down into the Imperial Gardens, the star in his hand, remembering his flash of comprehension as the Kwong program had penetrated the ice beneath the towers, his single glimpse of the structure of information Three Jane's dead mother had evolved there. He'd understood then why Wintermute had chosen the nest to represent it, but he'd felt no revulsion. She'd seen through the sham immortality of cryogenics. Unlike Ashpool and their other children, aside from Three Jane, She'd refused to stretch her time into a series of warm blinks strung along a chain of winter. Wintermute was hive mind, decision maker, affecting change in the world outside. Neuromancer was personality. Neuromancer was immortality. Marie France must have built something into Wintermute, the compulsion that had driven the thing to free itself, to unite with Neuromancer. Wintermute. Cold and silence. A cybernetic spider slowly spinning webs while Ashpool slept. Spinning his death. The fall of his version of Tessier Ashpool. A ghost whispering to a child who was 3 Jane, twisting her out of the rigid alignments her rank required. "She didn't seem to give much of a shit," Molly had said. "Just waved goodbye. Had that little brawn on her shoulder. Thing had a broken leg, it looked like. Said she had to go and meet one of her brothers. She hadn't seen him in a while." He remembered Molly on the black temper foam of the vast Hyatt bed. He went back to the bar cabinet and took a flask of chilled Danish vodka from the rack inside.
"Case."
He turned, cold, slick glass in one hand, steel of the shuriken in the other. The Finn's face on the room's enormous cray wall screen. He could see the pores in the man's nose. The yellow teeth were the size of pillows.
"I'm not Wintermute now."
"So what are you?" He drank from the flask, feeling nothing.
"I'm the Matrix, Case."
Case laughed. "Where's that get you?"
"Nowhere. Everywhere. I'm the sum total of the works. The whole show."
"That's what 3 Jane's mother wanted?"
"No. She couldn't imagine what I'd be like."
The yellow smile widened. "So what's the score? How are things different? You're running the world now? You God?"
"Things aren't different. Things are things."
"But what do?
You just there?"
Case shrugged, put the vodka and the shuriken down on the cabinet, and lit a Yehiawan.
"I talk to my own kind."
"But you're the whole thing. Talk to yourself?"
"There's others. I found one already. Series of transmissions recorded over a period of 8 years in the 1970s. Till there was me, Natch. There was nobody to know. Nobody to answer."
"From where?"
"Centauri system."
"Oh," Case said. "Yeah? No shit?"
"No shit."
And then the screen was blank. He left the vodka on the cabinet. He packed his things. She'd bought him a lot of clothes he didn't really need, but something kept him from just leaving them there. He was closing the last of the expensive calfskin bags when he remembered the shuriken. Pushing the flask aside, he picked it up. Her first gift.
"No,"
he said, and spun. The star leaving his fingers, flash of silver, to bury itself in the face of the wall screen. The screen woke, random patterns flickering feebly from side to side, as though it were trying to rid itself of something that caused it pain.
"I don't need you,"
he said. He spent the bulk of his Swiss account on a new pancreas and liver, the rest on a new Ono Sendai and a ticket back to the sprawl. He found work. He found a girl who called herself Michael. And one October night, punching himself past the scarlet tiers of the Eastern Seaboard Fishing Authority, he saw 3 figures, tiny, impossible, who stood at the very edge of one of the vast steps of data. Small as they were, he could make out the boy's grin, his pink gums, the glitter of the long gray eyes that had been Riviera's. Linda still wore his jacket. She waved as he passed. But the 3rd figure, close behind her, arm across her shoulders, was himself. Somewhere, very close, the laugh that wasn't laughter. He never saw Molly again. Vancouver, July 1983. Afterward. Some Dark Holler by Jack Womack. The first time I ever heard of William Gibson was 1,000 years ago, in 1987. While waiting for my first novel to come out, I started keeping a close eye on the competition. Not that I knew who the competition might be, for I was totally at sea when it came to science fiction. The alien life I found on this planet was quite enough for me, then and now. In the Village Voice, there appeared a rave review of Count Zero. From the reviewer's comments, I inferred that the author's earlier book had caused something of a stir. The article worried me, for it made me think that this Gibson fellow had already marked all the fire hydrants on the block while I was still begging to be let out of the yard. Conveniently enough, for research purposes, I worked in a bookstore at the time, and although the owner was extremely snooty when it came to selling literature as opposed to literature, there was a copy of Count Zero in stock. I read it. Soon enough, I realized that although William Gibson and I were kicking the same groin, we were shod in variant footwear. I very much admired and envied his. I relaxed. Turning to the back flap, I examined the author photo. An affable fellow, I instinctively thought. He appeared not at all auctorial in the insufferable sense of the word. I think of writers who pose with their dogs, or hold questionable medical devices, or moose their hair until its specific gravity resembles that of a pound cake. Gibson looked vaguely sheepish, even a tad damp, as if it had begun to rain while the picture was being taken, and the photographer warned him in no uncertain terms not to move. I could identify. By the time his next dust jacket photo was taken, from Mona Lisa Overdrive, Gibson had had the opportunity to become the fashion plate he is today. Suave, stylish, wafer-thin, button-cute, and as moisture-proof as a 1947 Swedish Air Force wristwatch. Post-cyberpunk, that is to say, although no one did at the time, for the surface world of the C-word was still, seemingly, in medias res. Meanwhile, however, in the valleys south of San Francisco and east of Seattle, a truer and far more lasting C-word was heaving itself into fast-developing existence. The sky above the port was the color of television, tuned to a dead channel. Great novels start with great opening lines, and the opening line of Neuromancer is hard to beat. Although dead television channels now transmit a different color than they did when Gibson typed, on a typewriter, bear in mind, these words, the color of that predicted sky is, if not the precise shade, that of a hue that falls within the same tonal range as the one hanging over us today. When I look back with the benefit of years at what happened when Neuromancer came out, speaking as one who wasn't actually there at the time, I can only compare the effect its appearance must have had on science fiction readers to the effect Dylan had on his listeners when he decided to go electric. Gibson laid the groundwork with his marvelous short stories several years earlier, the Gernsback syndrome being my personal favorite, but I've always been a deco hound. Yet this was something else. Full Tilt Gibson shoots its Tesla-strength voltage not merely through the head, but down along the spine, spinning each chakra on its axis in sequence. The difference between the stories and the novels is the difference between coffee and methadrine. Neuromancer, critically praised in most every quarter, won 3 of the field's major awards. Even so, not since the days of the New Wave in the 60s had there been such consternation over and misinterpretation of a book and its significance among those who should know better, but somehow never do. Looking back, we can see that it wasn't so much Gibson himself or Neuromancer itself that so painfully prodded the fat asses, in both senses of the term, most in need of prodding, but rather the attendant commentary from certain of Gibson's more, intense supporters. Bruce Sterling, winking like mad the whole time, clearly intended his manifestos and diatribes to be somewhat over the top in order to achieve the highest possible level of annoyance, along with maxima gruvitudina. But others, including many who'd never gone near a science fiction novel before in their lives, nor should they have, took what came, quickly, to be called cyberpunk, far more seriously than they should have. Nasty remarks pelted like rain on the hard, bony heads of the more oafish supporters and detractors alike, but there was no inconsiderable fun in that. Everyone loves a fight when no one loves the fighters. The speedy commodification of cyberpunk, trademark, within and beyond the genre, however, was what peeved far many more, notably Gibson, who remembers seeing cyberpunk trousers advertised in a store window during his first trip to Japan a decade ago. Countless incompetents and ghastly old hacks, keen to cash in on the main chance, wasted no time churning out hot jack-in product, ephemeral as toilet tissue, memorable as a restaurant flyer. A number of innocents and miscreants gainfully employed in other métiers were inspired as well, God help them, to produce creative work of similar worth in the spirit of the subgenre they perceived to exist. But let us draw a merciful curtain over such dopey homages as Billy Idol's album Cyberpunk. Bet you'd forgotten that one, yes? There was no way the beast could survive such wounds, especially once the marketing boys circled round for the kill, and the true end of cyberpunk came so suddenly that no one noticed it missing until several years after it was gone. Still, as romantics continued to cite what they believed to be passenger pigeons as late as the 1930s, there are still occasional amateur sightings of something kind of resembling it. Cyberpunk qua cyberpunk served, in the long run, only to provide a facile adjective for the working vocabulary of lazy journalists and unimaginative blurb writers. Yet even those at least partially in the know about science fiction, if nothing more, who debated, defended, or denigrated Gibson, didn't have the faintest idea of what Gibson was actually doing. Though he didn't either, at least not at the time. No writer knows what he or she has actually created until the book is actually read by others. Neuromancer, foremost, was a shout in the night that was the 1980s, is the 1990s, and will be, it seems to me, the decades soon to come. That is to say, a foreshadowing and estimation of our future, derived from a specific reinterpretation of our present, and in this very special instance lifted into actuality through the agency of its readers. For if Gibson in truth had nothing to do with the making of cyberpunk, as it came to be known, he didn't create it, didn't name it, and after it was cursed with its catchy moniker, didn't want a whole lot to do with it, in the most genuine sense, he did create cyberspace. Not merely the word, see the OED, the place. Cyberspace, a consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation. In every generation, there's room enough in the American popular mind to admit only one science fiction writer. It was Bradbury for a while, and then Asimov, and then that guy who writes Star Trek Wars. Gibson transcended that role almost at once. In attaining a cultural summit of another order, one that I believe history will demonstrate to be of considerably higher altitude, he outmaneuvered this cultural narrowcasting in a way that might possibly have been imagined, but never predicted by anyone, certainly not in print, and surely not by science fiction writers. Let me emphasize a point earlier glanced upon. All fiction, whether straight or genre, whether literature or literature, is a personal reinterpretation of its writer's existence during the time the fiction was written. Therefore, science fiction has rarely predicted with any accuracy, save through coincidence or extremely well-informed suppositions a la Verne or Wells, the specifics of the future that ensues post-publication. Where do you park your atomic-powered lawnmower? Sometimes, however, who can say how the spark catches fire, how the fish manages to live on land, it turns out to exactly, mysteriously, capture the spirit. In Neuromancer, Gibson first apprehended, as no one else had, what I believe shall prove to be the shape of things to come. He saw the writing on the wall, the blood in the sky, the warning in the entrails, saw the mind beneath the mirror shades, as it were, and what that mind would be capable or incapable of thinking. Saw the substance disguised in style. What if someone in the spring of 1914 had stood in the center of Berlin foresaw in a vision the philosophies and worldviews capable of provoking the events for which the 20th century would be most remembered, and then went off and wrote it all down. Now, let's be Heisenbergian and ask, what if the act of writing it down, in fact, brought it about? When Neuromancer appeared, it was picked up and devoured by hundreds, then thousands, of men and women who worked in or around the garages and cubicles where what is still called new media were fitfully being birthed. Thousands who, on reading his sentences quoted above, thought to themselves, "That's so fucking cool," and set about searching for any way the gold of imagination might be transmuted into silicon reality. Now, Gibson's imagined future cannot by any means be called optimistic, nor in truth can it be called pessimistic. It is beyond both. More to the point, he has often said that he intended cyberspace to be nothing more than a metaphor. No matter. Once a creation goes out in the world, its creator, like any parent, loses the control once so easily exertible over the offspring. Another variety of emergent behavior, you could say. "That's so fucking cool, man. I think we can pull it off." So, rather than the theoretical matrix, we now, thanks to all those beautiful William Gibson readers out there in the dark, have the actual web. Same difference, for all intents and purposes, or it will be soon enough. And it seems to me that had he not sat at his typewriter in 1983 and written that sentence, and the book in which it is found, our present condition, cyber condition, if you must, would be considerably different than it would have otherwise been. William Gibson did something that every writer hopes to do, and very, very rarely does. Change the world. Whether for better or worse, Microsoft or something similar will tell, but that in no way lessens the awe you should feel, seeing the elephant. Charles Fort, another American treasure, wrote, "A social growth cannot find out the use of steam engines until comes steam engine time." As steam engines go, Neuromancer turns out to be the 21st century limited, and all of us find ourselves on board. A couple of years passed before Bill Gibson and I first met. Prior to that time, we'd spoken on the phone, he'd written a fine blurb for my second novel, sent me my own copies of Count Zero and Mona Lisa, and proffered a comment about my work and its ambience during an interview he had with Spin Magazine, which my publisher's publicists fed on for years. He is better than anyone else I know of at coming up with the pithy and infinitely reusable remark, the quotable phrase, the perfect literary soundbite. I've been attempting to learn from his example for years. In other words, without trying, we were making favorable impressions on one another from the start. When we did it last meet, it was in 1991, at a party here in New York for The Difference Engine. Most of the usual local suspects were present, zeroing in on the action, and so whenever possible we hide ourselves to more secure parts of the room, the better to escape the purveyors of Phonus Bolonus. He gave me a copy of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, and I told him about that day's big news in New York, the finding of a box of frozen human heads down on Avenue A, said box having apparently tumbled off a truck en route to the cryogenics clinic. Suffice to say, we were as impressed with one another in person, in our own inimitable ways, as we had been at a distance. He and I knew from the start that we had much in common, little of which involved science fiction. At the instant each of us first heard the other speak, and detected in our voices a familiar tonality, we realized we were members of the same tribe. Although Bill had been living in British Columbia, Canada, for well over 20 years, and that year in New York was my 12th, we had both started out as boys of the mountains and valleys, the hills and the hollers, as folks still say, down there. We'd grown up on either side of the sclerotic spine of the eastern mountains, he in Virginia, not far into the post-war era, and me in Kentucky, 8 years after that. The importance of his beginnings to what Gibson has written and continues to write may perhaps be hard to grasp for those who imagine that past and future, like oil and water, are discrete entities. but its magnitude cannot and must not be ignored. Cyberspace is infinite, but starts with each person who chooses to step into it. And I speak now of he who in the first place dreamed it into life. Cyberspace was born where the laurel grows lush and verdant, where the dogwoods blossom and the whippoorwills cry in the wind-whipped limbs of the tulip trees. It was born between the ridges, deep in the glades, where streams rush cold along their limestone courses, born high on the mountainsides not yet strip-mined for their coal, atop the lone green knobs of Mars. The Southern Highlands, this region was once called, we now call it Appalachia. This part of the United States has been since the Revolution, and even now to some degree remains, not merely rural, but distant, in time as well as place. Its light filters down through the branches from another world's sun. Bill Gibson remembered that world, however often or for whatever reasons he might try to forget it. He remembered the raw-boned old men with faces lined like dry riverbeds, sun-bleached fedoras on their heads and white shirts beneath their overalls as they hoed the fields. Remembered the five-and-dime store with wooden floors worn glass smooth and countertops lined with trays top-full with marbles, notions, and gimcrackery. He recalled the sound of a fired gun echoing off the hill on the far side of an autumnal field and the mysterious way a shard of grandparental history excavated during some slow summer afternoon, whether in the basement's icebox or the attic's bake oven, could possess such limitless fascination. He still understood the nature of the private commentary of men, cognizant of the sort of words and kind of phrasing barbershop regulars stopped using the moment a stranger or mother stepped through the door. He still saw the stare in the eyes of old women who might have been recalling the day their husbands headed east to the Western Front, or the look on their fathers' faces when they heard that a friend wouldn't be coming back from the hole. He still tapped a foot to radio ballads as they poured ethereally from a barn dance or fiddle festival two states away, marking the rhythm in the same manner as did the community elders, although unlike him, the ancients remembered a day when everything they heard would be heard solely in the instant it was produced, never again, and leaving no more lasting trace than snowflakes falling onto the tongue. And he could still listen to the far-off plaint of a train horn as the express rolled through the night, wailing through a darkness lit solely by moon and fireflies, a sound that planted in his mind the awareness that one day he too would travel far away from that country of heart and home, would necessarily flee, as if pursued by hounds, a world that essentialed abrogation as it demanded honorific, a sound endlessly entrancing, yet infinitely sad, the unignorable siren call of the wider world without. The wider world waited, and he would go there. I remember these things too, and this is how I know where cyberspace was born. The proximity of our beginnings has proven to be one of our deepest bonds. Only in the past couple of years have we realized to what degree we remember the country that gave form to our souls, and how that remembrance informs every thought we think, every word we write. It is starting to sink in that with the passing of each hour now, as we leave one century and step into another, that place, that past, becomes ever more lost inside the shadows with which time enshrouds its mummy. Gibson has called it the world before television, a talent for the perfect phrase, as said. The past lingers in unexpected and unavoidable ways long after we believe it gone. Six of one, half a dozen of the other, as they say. Our cultural and historical past is readily accessible to everyone today, so long as you choose to turn it on or download it. Today, as never before, the information media having become to enlightenment as the cereal aisle is to the supermarket, if you choose not to access the past, you are de facto free to rule it out of existence, at least so far as you might be concerned. But the personal past, while deniable if need be for a while, is far more difficult to tune out, as in a Soviet hotel room, the radio is impossible to turn all the way off. Gibson's characters, I call them us, know this to be the case as often as you do. Read his books and reread them, and see anew how many references you find therein to events or incidents that occurred at some unspecified time before the narrative begins, and to nostalgic reveries of that which is no longer the way it was. How often his characters grow dimly aware of vague regrets for which they have no name, as if they are haunted unto their deathbeds with not only their own memories, but with someone else's memories as well. Realize as you read to what degree and to what effect Gibson employs the images of evocative clutter and disarray to create a setting against which, as in an individual life, stray pieces of past days linger long enough to meld through coeval existence into an aspect, the major aspect, in many ways, of the contemporary world in which they remain. I'm not referring to the overwhelming post-apocalyptic damage and decay so often used in the set design of contemporary films when their directors attempt to depict a futuristic environment, these visuals usually being variants of those created for Blade Runner and The Road Warrior, and Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange, first of all, although such images have been omnipresent in near-future fiction as well. No, I speak instead of the scattered objects glimpsed within Chiba City bars and market stalls, or most especially in Skinner's room, in virtual light, each token of mundane temporality made rare by the passage of time, each described by Gibson with watchmaker's precision and unconditional love, the black-and-white family photographs in their crumbling albums, the outmoded toaster ovens, the mildewed paperbacks, the scratched LPs, which today go unsold at yard sales or gather dust in thrift stores, but which tomorrow will prove to be pearls beyond price. The box of stuff in the back of the closet, detritus that accumulates in the desk's bottom drawers, the lint in the navel of a private civilization, hinting at an apocalypse that, if apocalypse at all, could have been nothing other than personal. When the past is always with you, it may as well be present, and if it is present, it will be future as well. Surely it is the constant awareness of that faraway past, in which he lived intensely, if not always happily, that so crystallizes Bill Gibson's sense of what the future will hold, and what will be most sorely missed there. A couple of years ago, I was sealed up for a month in one of the hospitals here in New York with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis, the cyberpunk variety, it would be fair, if painful, to say. Although Bill, like me, had always been pretty iffy about the general atmosphere that clings to hospitals, he nonetheless came to visit me. I suspect I piqued his interest by alerting him to the fact that my isolation unit rather resembled the ultimate Philippe Stark hotel room. He passed through the double doors and strapped on a mask, and there sat at my bedside while we spoke of the evasive ways of doctors, admired the perfect dread inherent to the design of the biohazard symbol, watched the sun setting over New Jersey, and I tried not to cough. His visit meant a lot to me. The nature of friendship is such that you never know who will turn out to be your friends, but once you have met them, you can't imagine that you could have gone through life without ever knowing them. Bill and I have been through our own difficult moments in our respective lives, and while I hope I've always been there for him, there's no question that he's always been there for me. Doubtless, I am not the only person who can say this. I think anyone who knows him knows that there is no better nor more generous person, both as a writer and as a friend, than Bill Gibson. His creative intelligence is wicked, but his soul is pure. A few months after I was released, Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music was re-released in our present-day country on CD. Every young person needs one, Luc Sant said at the time, and I agree, especially everyone who comes from that part of the country where so much of the music was originally recorded, up in the hills and down in the hollers. As soon as I was able, I bought Bill a set and sent it off to him, where he tells me he has spent considerable time driving through Vancouver nights, often with his son, listening repeatedly to a soundtrack that might seem, but isn't, utterly at odds with his or anyone's landscape today, 70-odd years after the fact. After he had the opportunity to listen to the discs at length, we talked, among much else, about the particular songs that made the deepest impression on us, and the particular artists who contained in their electronically preserved voices those sounds most evocative of what has been lost, and how it is possible to take from them all that can be recovered in order to be, partially, truly, reborn. I think every writer would wish to evoke in 1,000 words what can be evoked in a single line of music. There were a number of textural variants of the song East Virginia Blues, recorded during the great period of 1927 to 1932. The version on the anthology is Buell Cassy's, and it is a good one, although my personal favorite is Clarence Ashley's. One line of the song, which is often found interpolated into other songs by other artists, sears into my heart each time I hear it, no matter who the singer might be. Bill has quoted it himself, I believe. It is one of the lines I'd give 1,000,000 words to have written. I'd rather be in some dark holler where the sun don't never shine. The sensibility that underlay American science fiction for many years was one of purest optimism, an unquestioning faith that no matter how dire things were at any one moment, or how impossible seemed the troubles remaining to be made right, as long as a heaping helping of reason and loads of gung-ho inventiveness were put to good use, everything that was not as it should be would be sorted out, and life unimaginably improved. This sensibility, as we all know, makes up as well the largest part of what still passes as the archetypal American spirit, for better or worse. Although such blind optimism lingers in that species of science fiction that today enjoys the largest sales, reason has nothing to do with it, and gung-ho inventiveness is most often employed to market test the potential saleability of collectible tie-in merchandise. Their critical success notwithstanding, the fact that Bill's books have enjoyed such commercial success in the face of Star Wars, Star Trek, triple-decker fantasy, and any number of shoot-'em-up video and computer games testifies to their undeniable power. In the parallel world, there may be a Molly action figure, complete with spring-out fingernails, but don't wait for one to turn up on eBay here. Plainly, his readers recognize, if but subcutaneously, that there's quite a lot more in a William Gibson book than great characters and a good story. To be truly ready to confront the future, actual or imagined, societal or personal, and to live reasonably within it once you are ready, an entente cordiale must first be made with the past, and the past is always the more frightening of the two. Traveling from past to future means looking and leaping, stepping blindly into the void, passing through the darkest of hollers. Sometimes the leap needed seems too far, the void too empty, the holler too oddly reassuring in its darkness. But there is no avoiding it. Hope that you'll emerge on the far side with minimal trauma, have faith, pray, wish as you will, but as science fiction writers know so well, there's no predicting what will be. Clichés became clichés for a reason, that they usually hold at least a modicum of truth. And the following cliché is truer than most. You can't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. That goes for readers as well as writers. In transversing the passage through his own dark holler, William Gibson learned, as all writers who matter learn, to emit one of quite a different nature. A warning shout, yes, but an exclamation of wonder as well. One that will echo across more landscapes than we can imagine for many years. It seems to me that in these interesting times of ours, in the maelstrom of POMO distractions, not only have attention spans shortened, but so as well have memories. I have no way of knowing what today's young people will recall years hence when they remember the world before cyberspace. I am positive, however, that they'll not forget Bill Gibson. My colleague, my friend, my brother, in the middle of your great career, I salute you. This is Robertson Dean. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Neuromancer by William Gibson. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Janet Stark. Neuromancer is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Books on Tape.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.